Welcome back to the Replacement Refs, and welcome back to the Kaufman Show at a reasonable hour. How you all doing out there, including the guy across from me? How are you doing, Jay Farrar?
How are you, Dave Kaufman?
I'm great, buddy. That sounded very angry.
I'm fine, Dave Kaufman.
What, you don't like being here for the third time today?
No, it's what I do.
Okay.
It's what I do.
All right.
I had a few visits to do to a few jobs today.
Wow.
Yeah,
I'm here. That sounds nice and vague.
Yes. It's going to stay that way, too. I'm okay. Not mad, Dave.
I can tell.
I just sound mad.
Oh, this is going to be a really fun hour and a half.
Oh, here we go.
Is this because I informed you right before we went on air that the Washington Nationals won the NL East tonight?
Oh, son of a...
Hi, Jay. Hi, buddy. How you doing? Take a deep breath.
No. I'm fine. I don't want to see the celebrating. I don't want to see... Washington in a... I don't want to see parades. I don't want to see anything like that. What I do want to see is the Washington Nationals win, though. And I want to see the reaction in this town. It's very, very interesting to me.
We'll get into that tonight, my friend.
Okay.
Well, as all the other races that are going on, A's are playing the Rangers right now. Angels are playing the Mariners. There's serious playoff implications all across the board. And
not only that, when it's all said and done, you've got these one game survivor games.
Exactly.
So, I mean, it's quite interesting.
It's going to make for a hell of a week.
It will.
That's for sure.
Yeah.
And I'm stoked about it. And we've got a wonderful show for you all tonight. I'm really excited for you to hear our
giddy.
Interviews.
You're giddy.
Am I giddy?
You're giddy.
Are you fine?
Oh, yeah. Okay. You've been giddy all day.
It's the contrast
your
between
hands
my giddiness
have been
and how miserable you are.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's... What did you say earlier? It's our
yin and yang.
And
yeah.
That's it.
Yeah. Well, you know, that seemed to go over so well before that we figured we'd bring it up again, right?
Exactly.
This is the Kaufman Show. Coming up right after the break, we're going to be joined by J.R. Moringer, Pulitzer Prize winner, New York Times bestselling author of The Tender Bar, wonderful memoir. If you haven't picked it up, please do. And he just wrote a novel called Sutton, about Willie Sutton. And he even reads a little bit for us. It's going to be a lot of fun. After that, we've got Paul Langlois from The Tragically Hip. Do I need to say anything else?
There's the giddy part.
There's
That's
the
where
giddy
part,
huh?
comes in.
Yeah. Yeah. Could you tell which interview I was more nervous for today, Jay?
To tell you the truth, I think you were a little more nervous for J.R. Moringer.
Well, I've met Paul Langlois a couple
exactly.
of times.
You seemed a little more at ease, and you also, you know, you knew all the right questions, and you're pretty much a Tragically Hip expert. Everyone who's anyone knows this about Dave Kaufman, so.
All right, let's take a break. Back to baseball with this break. That's right, Jimmy. Jimmy G on the board. Russ Hodge is taking us out. Bring it up.
Last of the ninth, Bragg pitches. Bobby Thompson takes a strike call on the inside corner. Bobby hitting at 292. He's had a single and a double, and he drove in the Giants' first run with a long fly to center. Brooklyn leads it 4-2. Hartung down the line at third, not taking any chances. Lockton without too big of a lead at second, but he'll be running like the wind if Thompson hits one. Bragg throws. There's a long strike! It's going to be, I believe!
Kaufman Show. I'm Dave Kaufman. I'm with my co-host Jay Farrar. Jimmy G's on the board. Johnny K in the other room, editing up a storm. That was Bruce Springsteen's Shackled and Drawn, a song that I've thought about. In fact, that whole album, Wrecking Ball, really goes well with J.R. Moringer's Sutton. And settle in, because for the next 20 minutes or so, you're going to be hearing all about this wonderful book. And
were you playing Wrecking Ball while you were reading it?
No, but I was listening to it. I don't usually listen to music while I read.
I was going to ask you that.
No,
that's,
I don't.
That's interesting.
I don't watch TV when I read. It's just...
You know what I play? I play classical music while I read.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
It's interesting. It's like a soundtrack to a movie.
Let me give you a little synopsis of the book.
Okay.
When Willie Sutton, the Babe Ruth of bank robbers, was released from Attica on Christmas Eve 1969, he had stolen more than $2 million from banks, engineered three dazzling prison breaks, and become a folk hero to thousands of cash-strapped Americans who had weathered three serious depressions while the banks rode high. Sutton was 68 and in failing health, but he agreed to do an interview. This is Moringer's fictional tale on that real-life event as Sutton, gruffly addressing the reporter and photographer as kids, is driven all over New York City, driven the places that shaped him for good or ill. So, without any further ado, we asked JR if he wouldn't mind reading a little bit from the book today. So, he sets it up well enough that I don't think I have to.
If you have any children in the room, remove them.
I don't... Okay.
And, I'm trying to entice people into listening. That's what you do.
That does it? Okay.
Yeah.
Well,
okay,
say it one more time then.
If there are any children in the room, please ask them to leave.
This is one of Willie's many escape attempts. This is at Sing Sing. He gets word from one of his fellow prisoners, TikTok, that there's a sewer pipe that runs under the yard and it might lead to freedom. That there's a hole in the pipe, and so he takes three guys with him, and they slip into this basement, and they encounter what you might expect to encounter in a sewer. Willie slips in first, then the three lifers. They run down to the basement, find the loose floorboard. They pry it up. They kick off their shoes and socks and strip to their underwear. One by one, they drop through the hole in the floor. They land on the sewer pipe, in which, sure enough, there's a man-sized hole. The last one through the hole in the pipe is Willie. He lands with a loud splash. Warm water comes to his shins. Not water exactly, more like East River muck mixed with apple chutney. It squishes between his toes, slides between his calves, his thighs. He carries an electric torch stolen from a supply room. He clicks it on. Bugs the width of field mice slither away, up and down the sides of the pipe. The beam of light barely pierces the darkness. It picks out a mound of waste here, a bigger mound there, an iceberg of gauze and bandages from the prison infirmary. Willie remembers that the prison was built 100 years ago. He whips the beam back and forth and thinks, a century worth of human. He feels the three lifers staring at him. He faces them. All three are big, tough, heartless. But a childlike terror fills their eyes. Willie creeps forward. The three lifers follow. After 20 feet, the pipe abruptly slopes down. The muck rises to their hips. Don't think about it, he tells the lifers, but he's really telling himself. He tries to think of Chapin's garden and the grounds of Greystone and Bess's delicate perfume, but it's not easy when the muck turns to custard and rises to his belly. Now his nipples, shoulders. He recalls the guards in their towers squatting over their slop buckets. He wonders which guard is responsible for this particular scoop of custard now bobbing against his chin. At last, as the custard reaches his bottom lip, Willie decides they must be near the end of the pipe, meaning they must be at the wall. Beyond, there's supposed to be a basin, then a manhole, then the street. He motions for the lifers to follow. They shake their heads, nothing doing. Alone, Willie steels himself, presses forward. As the lifers watch in horror, he hands them the electric torch, shuts his eyes, pinches his nose, dives. He wriggles ahead, no basin. He reaches out with his right hand, no basin. He swims and slithers another few feet, still no basin. Running out of air, he starts to panic and loses his bearings. He's suddenly not sure which way is forward, which way is back. He turns, swims a few feet, reaches, prays that his hand will touch the knee or thigh of a lifer. Nothing. His lungs are begging him to inhale, but if he opens his mouth, he knows what will fill it and rush up his nose and down his throat. He reaches, at last feels something hard, a lifer. He grabs hold, pulls, breaks the surface with a violent gasp. He smears a PAP on his face so that he can open his eyes. The lifers are staring. He can't tell if it's horror or pity in their expressions. His head, hair, eyes are covered, slathered with this. He can't avoid the word anymore. Shit. His mouth is full of it. He coughs. He spits and spits. Shit, shit, shit. Now they all turn, peer down the pipe at the darkness into which Willie just ventured. That way lies freedom beyond a solid sea of shit.
After J.R. read that captivating chapter for us, which frankly was hard to read when I was reading it. It was also a little bit squeamish to listen to, so I hope you all enjoyed it. Our interview started by I asked J.R. if Sutton was his reaction to the global financial crisis.
Oh, very much. I had started a book with kind of a sports theme, and I'd done a lot of work on it. It was a book more about college football, and I was really enjoying researching it, and I had a pretty good sense of where it was going and how long it would take. But this was late 2008, 2009, and the world was ending, and bankers seemed to be the cause of the apocalypse, and I was getting angrier and angrier, and I thought, you know, maybe now is the time to write about that anger and from the point of view of that anger and explore that anger, and I set aside the college football book because I thought it would be it was the right moment to write about banks, and I thought a good way of writing about banks, from at least from my point of view, would be to write about somebody who hated them almost as much as I do. And that's Willie Sutton, who once upon a time was the face of American bank robbery. And I was shocked that there hasn't been a book about Willie already, other than the two memoirs he wrote, which cancel each other out because they're both fiction and self-contradictory. I was amazed that there's been no novel about him, no biography. So it just seemed like the way was clear. It seemed like the moment was right. It seemed like it would really fit the tenor of the times, the zeitgeist, to explore a guy who led kind of a 40-year war against banks.
How aware were you of the previous global meltdowns of the 20th century? Because frankly, until reading your book, other than the Great Depression and the early 80s, it was not something I was very much aware of.
Yeah, no, me neither. I mean, I was dimly aware that the history of capitalism is a history of crashes and recoveries, but I didn't know there had been so many similar crises similar to the one that we suffered in 2008 and 2009, bank panics and banks demanding bailouts and banks over-leveraged and housing bubbles. And I didn't know that chronic unemployment was such a cyclical problem. I didn't know that, you know, how much the crash of exactly 100 years before, the crash of 1907, was similar, and that banks were teetering until they were bailed out and that they were too big to fail. And I didn't know about the crash of 1893 and the huge recession that followed World War I. And I didn't know about the crashes of the mid-1800s. And I mean, there was a period there where sort of every 15 or 20 years there was another cataclysmic crash. And I was amazed that we have such short memories. And I hoped to kind of reinforce that point in the book, that we all thought 2008, 2009 was so incredibly different. And really it was just... it was just a rerun. It was a repeat, and none of us were around to catch the first airings. And for that matter, 87, which I did live through, but I didn't realize how similar and how interconnected these things all are.
One of the ways that I found that Willie can relate to the common man once he's already robbed the banks and made his millions is through sports. Talks a lot about sports, wishing that he was compared to Jackie Robinson instead of Babe Ruth. He's in a bar in Brooklyn during the shot heard around the world. He goes to Yankee Stadium opening day in 1923. Do you think that still exists nowadays, that escape with sports, or has sports gotten too big?
Well, I do think sports has gotten too big, but I don't think that keeps it from being an escape for all of us. And I think it has... you know, at least as much, probably more cultural importance as it did in Willie's day. I thought that connecting Willie to sports helped me make the point that we find heroes, cultural heroes, in unlikely places. And it's improbable that we make these athletes so iconic, that we make them into such heroes, because they're often so undeserving. But it's no less, you know, odd that we make bank robbers and criminals like Capone or Dillinger into folk heroes. I mean, we have a strange selection process, winnowing process for our cultural heroes. and I was interested in exploring how Willie Sutton came to be called by New York City cops the Babe Ruth of bank robbers. I mean, they had been chasing him. They'd been frustrated by him. They had spent all this time and money trying to find him. And then when they catch him, they sort of pay him a compliment. They call him the Babe Ruth of bank robbers. That hardly casts him in a sinister light for the public. So, yeah, I used sports in the book as a way of reinforcing the idea that I was exploring about how it is that certain people rise to become household names in America and in North America.
Did you grow up hearing about the legend of Willie Sutton at Dickens?
I did. I mean, I heard about him all the time because when I was a kid, real young, Willie Sutton was really known by everybody. Nowadays, I say I wrote a book about Willie Sutton, I get blank stares. He's faded from public consciousness. But when I was a kid, everybody knew the name Willie Sutton. And the guys in my uncle's bar and my grandparents and people in my hometown, they would mention him with kind of a wry smile and a shake of the head, because Willie Sutton was like a Robin Hood figure. You know, he was sticking it to the man. People put on him all these motives that I don't think he had. They ascribed a kind of nobility to him, and plus the fact that he was nonviolent, he never fired a shot, the fact that he was a master of escape, no prison was built that could hold him. I mean, all these things conspired to make the adults around me kind of admire him. And then when I was a very pivotal age, you know, when I was 11 or 12, his memoir came out, and it was kind of a big deal at the time. And he was the toast of New York for a little while. And I was very confused by this. I thought, why is this bank robber, this career criminal, so not only unrepentant, but kind of famous and kind of lionized? And why is he on Dick Cavett and Merv Griffin? And why does he wear these beautiful suits? And he's photographed in Life magazine. I mean, it really upended my moral schema. That all formed a foundation, a basis of knowledge. And then he came to mind again in 2008. So I already knew about him when I started thinking about different ways of writing about banks.
We're in conversation with author J.R. Moringer on The Kaufman Show, Dave Kaufman and Jay Farrar.
Jerry, you speak about idolizing, you know, how people idolize Sutton himself. What about, did this book change your opinion about criminals in general and the prison system?
Well, no. I want to be clear. I want to be emphatic. I have no love for criminals. I have no love for bank robbers. This is not a glamorization of Willie. It's a look at why he became glamorized. It's a look at why he was so liked and idolized, and why when he was finally caught in 1952, crowds gathered outside his jail and chanted his name. It's an exploration of that, but it's not an apology for Willie, and it's not a gloss on him. And every time in the book that you start to like him or fall under his spell, you're brought up short. You're reminded, wait a minute, maybe I need to reconsider this. I mean, as America once did with Willie Sutton, America took a hard look at him and said, wait a minute, maybe we've made a terrible mistake with this guy. So the book hasn't changed what I think about criminals. I always knew that there are complex causes behind crime. I know that people who are victimized by the economic system sometimes feel they have no choice but to commit crimes, and I don't sanction that or validate it, but I think it deserves to be spoken about and understood. I mean, in a country where unemployment is, you know, it depends on who you ask, let's pick a number, 15%, I understand that some people are desperate and some people are driven to make terrible choices by, you know, forced by the prospect of being on the street, and I don't forgive that. I don't sanction it, but I think we have to deal with it and discuss it rationally. As far as prisons go, this book didn't change my mind of prisons. I've always had a horror of them. I have a touch of claustrophobia anyway. I mean, I don't even like flying, you know, in coach. The idea of being in a dungeon for 15, 25 years is just that's my living nightmare. And so the idea that Willie Sutton not only survived these brutal places, but escaped them every time is fascinating to me. And even though it's illogical, even though I know that it's wrong that he escaped, there is something about that will to live and the kind of incredible, cleverness that he showed, his elusiveness. It's fascinating to me. I went and sat in the cell at Eastern State Penitentiary. Where they don't know exactly what cell he was kept in, but they know it's one of these over here. And so you go in, the curator stands outside. It's not like Alcatraz. It's not like, you know, Disneyland. It's hardcore. The prison's now a National Historic Site. Just being in there for a few seconds made me start to just creep out. And I could imagine unraveling psychologically within a day in that cell. The idea that you could actually sit in that cell and plot your escape is, to me, it's just incredible. It says a lot about this guy's will to live. And so I guess far from changing what I think about prisons, writing this book just reinforced my horror of them.
One of the ways that I find the reader is endeared to Willie is through his times in prison and kind of struggling along and trying to deal with the time. And I feel like that's a way that the reader gets to know him very well. Now, you mentioned that there are a few times in the book where, well, you said that as soon as you like Willie, at one point you take it away. And I can think of three specific points that I don't really want to get into in great detail because I don't want to ruin it for anybody who hasn't read it. But did you find yourself buying into the mystique? And would you sort of put those moments in to remind yourself as well that
we shouldn't be falling
in love with this character?
The thing to remember when you're reading this book is that, you know, I did a lot of research, a lot of reporting before I started to write. And what I was struck by is that the cops who chased him and caught him, the lawyers who represented him, the wardens and the guards who locked him up, the ghostwriters who wrote his memoirs and the interviewers who spent time with him, they all reported the same thing. He's impossible not to like. His literary agent is still around today and tells stories about the guy just being kind of this effervescent spirit. So his likability was a fact. And I think that that's really interesting. And I also think it's dangerous. I think it's what made him kind of dangerous. It's what made him a legend and a folk hero. So yes, I would catch myself buying into the mystique, and then that would give me an incentive to turn the plot one way or another. But this is a complex matter. I mean, because I also don't want to overcompensate in the other direction. It's a fact that in this day and age, in this culture, we have this reaction to criminals that, you know, we can't justify. Whether it's Butch Cassidy in The Sundance Kid or Gandolfini in The Sopranos, there is something about that antisocial impulse that draws us closer. We live vicariously through it. We wish we could rebel on some level. It's not real. It's not really rational. It's not really conscious. But there is a part of us that responds to the outlaw. And so I don't want to be judgmental in either way. I just wanted to create a portrait of this guy that would be that would capture his spirit. And I just wanted to tell a story that I just thought was a hellaciously good story, which had been kind of faded from the history books.
Did you find the newspaper article that's essentially the essence of the story?
Yes, I did.
Yeah. Was it as bad as you allude to?
Well, I don't really think I call the guys out as bad journalists.
No, but they come across as very, you know, green.
I think I just say that the article contains, you know, some lies and some errors and you know, it didn't have a lot of information. And that's not, I don't think that's the fault necessarily of the two journalists. I mean, I have interviewed guys right when they got out of jail. Believe me, you're the last person they want to spend time with. They've just been locked up for 10, 15, 20 years. They don't want to hang with a reporter, you know. So they're not going to give you their undivided attention, and they're traumatized with this experience. It's hard to get people like that to open up. And then on top of that, Willie knew when he walked out of jail in 1969 that he was going to write a memoir, that a memoir was his only way of making any legitimate, honest money. So he wasn't going to give these guys the best stories. He wasn't going to, you know, he wasn't going to give anything away for free. He made a deal with a newspaper that if they flew him down to New York City from Attica, he would take them around and show them the scenes of his heists and other landmarks in his remarkable life. And he was good to his bargain, but the story just doesn't have much. And then also he was just incapable of saying anything straight. Telling the truth was not in his skill set. So a lot of the stuff he told them was just inaccurate, wrong, bogus. And I don't fault him for that either. That's just who he was by the time he walked out of jail at 68 years old.
Taking a tour of New York City, I think it, well, first of all, it gave the reader a great vividness of what New York used to be like. And I imagine that was the New York of your childhood, essentially.
Yeah, 69 is, you know, that's a golden age in New York. And there are many golden ages, but that's such a funky, interesting, cool time in the city. I mean, it was exploding with energy, and all kinds of countercultural forces were swirling. And so my grandmother took me into the city to see a show at Radio City Music Hall when, you know, not long after 69. So I feel like I was there. I feel like I remember the energy of it. And I had fun recreating it and reliving it. But also, since the story sweeps back and forth between that day when Willie gives the two journalists a tour and other New Yorks, I had fun exploring the magic of, you know, New York of the early 1900s and New York of the 30s and New York of the 50s. So there are different New Yorks that I get to live in and recreate for the reader in the book. And that's one thing that appealed to me about the story overall, but also about using this structure.
You worked with a fact checker, right?
Yes, I hired a fact checker, a guy named Eric Mercado, who has worked with me on other things before, fact-checked the book I did with Andre Agassi, and he's a wonderful fact-checker, works for Los Angeles Magazine. And I told him, I said, well, this is really the toughest task I've ever given you, because some of this stuff is wrong and I don't know it. Some of it is wrong and I do know it. Some of it is both wrong and right, and we'll talk about it. And he sent me the manuscript back, and it was highlighted in different colors. The green was definitely wrong. The yellow needed double check. So he gave into the system, and together we assembled a book. It's very rigorously fact checked, and where a fact is wrong, I know it's wrong, or where it's not verifiable, I know it's not verifiable. So I feel like I know, you know, I can answer to each thing that someone might point to and say, this isn't correct.
Good, I've got one. I'm a massive baseball fan, and seeing that Willie paid $200 a ticket to go to the opening day of Yankee Stadium in 1923, I think it was.
Right.
I mean, that's more than it costs for a ticket at Yankee Stadium nowadays in today's dollars.
I know, but that has been fact-checked. We went back and forth about this, and what I found amazing about prices of things, like, for instance, rents at that time in New York were as high as they are. Well, I won't say that they are quite as high as they are now, but they are comparable to modern rents. The prices of things were surprisingly modern, you know, clothes and so forth. And I looked and found articles about people buying tickets outside the stadium, and they were paying more than $200. So I decided nobody will believe, you know, it was more. So we settled on that number, and it does sound exorbitant, but also I think you'll find around that section he's paying thousands for an apartment, and people have said that can't be possible back then. But it's true. Prices run in cycles along with history.
I thought that was just unbelievable.
They
talked last year when the new stadium.
Didn't Babe Ruth make $1 million at that point? Wasn't that?
Pardon?
Wasn't Babe Ruth making $1 million by then?
Yeah, but he had a better year than Herbert Hoover, is the quote.
Right, I know. But I had all the New York Times. I had a bunch of New York Times bound, and I would use them as a kind of reference for what things cost back then, and you know, whether it be a suit or a cup of coffee or a meal. And so I remember we had a discussion about this, about what it would cost to buy a scalp ticket outside the stadium. And we'd found different things online and different things in newspapers, and we settled on that number. So if we got it wrong, and if we could get in the Wayback Machine and set it to the first game at Yankee Stadium, let's put it this way, it's not for lack of discussion.
Finally, because we've kept you on way longer than I promised your publisher we would, what's it like having a book written and coming out about somebody else? And I mean, obviously you were very personally attached to the Agassi book because you were writing in his voice, and well, Tender Bar is you. So how does it feel to represent a book that's nothing to do with you?
Are you talking about the Agassi book or this one now?
I'm talking about this one now. I feel like that for the Agassi book, I mean, you wrote in the first person. You essentially morphed into Andre Agassi writing that book.
I know. I felt like I had won Wimbledon and the French Open by the time we were.
Well, you also had Brooke Shields, so that was pretty good.
Yeah, way to go.
No, but it's the same, but it's very similar to the Agassi book. It's me and it's not me. I inhabited Agassi's psyche in order to write about him, and I did it sometimes with him sitting right next to me and sometimes alone. And we were partners in the process, but writing is solitary no matter how you slice it up. So I had company sometimes, and I was alone. It felt the same with this. You know, I was inhabiting Willie's psyche, and sometimes I felt him breathing over my shoulder, and sometimes I was winging it. And it's impossible to keep your own point of view out when you're writing in the first person. And then other times I was having him say things or do things that were completely alien to me. So it's more comparable to the Agassi book than you would think. And the Agassi book was a great dry run for this because I was writing about a life that was completely alien from mine. I mean, professional tennis player from Las Vegas with his own plane and married to Brooke Shields. That's not, you know, I have no frame of reference. And so it was great practice to put myself in another man's shoes. And the difference was that when I was stuck, Agassi was always a phone call or, you know, a few blocks away, and he was fully invested in the process. And so I was never stuck for very long. When I was stuck with Willie, there was no one I could call. I could only consult old books and old newspapers and his bogus, error-filled memoirs. So I had to be more at peace with mistakes in my depiction of Willie Sutton, whereas with Agassi, he and I were determined to get it exactly right. At a certain point, I just had to let my imagination and also my logic off the leash and just say, I'm just gonna feel this, and I'm gonna follow my feelings and hope that I arrive at a kind of an intangible truth, a more abstract truth in this book. So you're onto something there. They're more alike than even I first realized they'd be at the beginning.
J.R. Moringer is the author of Sutton, which is in stores now, published by Hyperion. J.R., thank you so much for your time today.
I enjoyed it. I'll talk to you guys down the road.
That was fun, AJ.
Beautiful.
Our thanks to J.R. Moringer.
Nice guy.
Yeah, fantastic guy. And by all means, go out and buy his three books, The Tender Bar, Open with Andre Agassi, and Sutton, the story of Willie the Actor, the Babe Ruth of bank robbers. This is The Kaufman Show.
Hi, my name's Paul Langlois. I play with the Tragically Hip, and you're listening to The Kaufman Show.
Done and done. I never get my way. You always get your way. I never get my way. Done and done. Talk about me. I'll listen for hours, cause I don't know how it ends. Through, through, through and through. Through, through, just get your way. I never get my way. You always get your way.
Welcome back to the Kaufman Show. We are now joined by Paul Langlois from the Tragically Hip. Their new album, Now for Plan A, comes out tomorrow. Or I guess if you have iTunes, tonight at midnight. Now,
that's right.
This is hey Paul, you're joining us live right now from essentially the Tragically Hip store in downtown Toronto right now, right?
Yeah, weird. Yeah. Really, we've never had a store before, but yeah, we're getting used to it.
What brought about this concept?
Oh, I don't know. There's lots of people taking credit for it. I don't actually know whose idea it was, but yeah, you know, it was just kind of we were mulling over what to do for the actual release, the CD release, and yeah, someone suggested, you know, why don't you do sort of a pop-up kind of thing where you play, you know, you hang around the store all day and play a few sets and meet some people and that kind of thing. So, yeah, you know, we're quite happy with the CD, so we thought, oh, it'd be kind of fun to try it.
Looking at the pictures of it on social media, it kind of has that feel of the old Much Music shows back in the day on Queen Street when you guys would sort of lean out over the barriers and play for the fans on Queen.
Yeah, a little similar to that. Yeah, certainly yesterday that we're in an area called Kensington Market, and it was sort of a, you know, a festival of sorts already going on down here. And yeah, so we were basically in the window of the store and playing. And then today we moved kind of to the back of the store, and the store is actually, it's called the supermarket. It's actually a kind of a restaurant-y bar kind of place. And yeah, everyone seems happy. We're having a good time so far.
So the new album, it's been streaming on SoundCloud for a couple of weeks. I guess a bunch of fans have gotten to hear it. But new producer, new experience, I would imagine. No Hawaii this time. How was it making the album?
Yeah, it was great. It was a bit of a marathon leading up to it. You know, I think we were kind of a year and a half in the writing process. And it's not like we were together all the time. So we're just kind of getting together here and there. And you know, we were, the songs were good, but I think we were all just kind of waiting to be really excited by it, and we weren't. And so then we brought in Gavin Brown, who we kind of all knew a little bit, well, at least to, we knew who he was. And anyway, he was great. We hit it off with him right away, and once he got involved, and we continued the writing process with him, you know, sort of just, you know, taking part, being there, sort of objective ears, and yeah, I had a great time recording with him, and it all went smooth, and we all had a good time.
What songs on the album stand out to you?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, you know, specifically with songs, you know, there's certainly there's some variety, you know. And, you know, the thing about this record is we played it all at the same time, chord included, with singing. And we just recorded, you know, versions of us playing the song live in the studio, which kind of sounds funny. I mean, you'd think that's how you do it. That's not really how it happens very often. So, you know, I think that comes through on the record. You know, some of the Good Night Ottawa Piscad is a tune that seems to be fun to play, Modern Spirit. We're just kind of playing them for the first time in this little store situation, and so far so good.
Good Night Attawapiskat is one that actually jumped out at me when I first listened to it. After reading the Joseph Boyden article in Maclean's about your trip to Fort Albany, I imagine that song is kind of the response to your trip, right?
Well, it's certainly a response. Yeah, and you know, that trip all affected us, and you know, it in a good way. It was good to get up there and just kind of try to shed some positive light onto the communities up there, you know, on the James Bear Shore, just that are struggling, Attawapiskat especially. That hey, you know, there's great people up there, and you know, they're living their lives, and they're not you know, it's not all about complaining and negative stuff. They're actually great, fun people, and we had a great time. We weren't in Attawapiskat, but we were in Fort Albany down the way a bit, and yeah, we just had a great time, and And we were grateful to Joseph for inviting us up there.
We're in conversation with Paul Langlois from the Tragically Hip, Dave Kaufman, and Jay Farrar.
Hey, Paul, it's Jay. Nice to talk to you.
Yeah, you too, Jay.
Just a little memory before I ask my question. I was at Woodstock 99, and I'll never forget it, the sea of Canadian flags and the fans not letting guys coming in close to the stage unless they show some sort of Canadian ID. There was like a lineup, a barrier that they had formed, and they wouldn't let anybody get close to you guys if they weren't Canadian. So that was just a great memory of I had, and I saw you guys there, and it was a great show. I know you're a hockey fan, and I know you're close to the game.
And a Habs fan at that.
And a Habs fan at that, so he is perfect. Perfect music, perfect fandom. I mean, the obvious question is your thoughts on the current lockout situation.
Well, I mean, I don't think I would really be able to offer anything new perspective-wise. You know, I certainly feel like probably a lot of other fans do, a lot of other people that follow the game. I mean, it's unfortunate, you know, partly uncomfortable to watch both sides, you know, arguing over a pile of money. But at the same time, you know, if I had to come down on a side, I'd lean a little more towards the players than I maybe would have in the last one. You know, I don't know all the issues in the, you know, and the bargaining agreement inside out at all. But I don't know, 50-50 always sounds like a good sort of way to go. But, you know, I mean, I was glad to see they talked this weekend. But
you just want to see some hockey like the rest of us, basically.
Yeah, you know, I do have, you know, living in Kingston, I'm hoping it helps the Frontenacs, the junior team there, you know, just to get people because, you know, attendance-wise, they could use a little more support. And maybe, you know, without the NHL in the first part of the OHL season, maybe that'll help the Frontenacs. But that's about the only positive I would see.
Well, if we're seeing a Tragically Hip winter arena tour, it might give you guys a little more wiggle room picking out your dates.
Yeah, well, you're probably right, yeah. I mean, I don't know. We'll see. I mean, you know, I think we all know that that hockey will be back, and you just got to find other things to do. Watch the Ryder Cup, I guess.
Well, we can also call that my backwards way of asking you when there's going to be a winter. If there's going to be a winter,
and if you're coming here.
Oh, don't worry. I was aware you were doing that.
Ryder Cup, you can't escape the golf stuff, eh?
No, it was big, actually. We were in the store here yesterday with no TV around, so it was kind of killing me that I didn't get to see that. But so I was following that pretty closely.
And
to answer your previous question, we're going to tour. We're going down the States in November and December, and we're going to tour Canada soon after that.
Good. We hope to see you guys in Montreal. It's been a long time since the just under an hour set at Oceaga a couple of summers ago.
Oh, right. Yeah, that was fun. No, we always enjoy Montreal every time.
Now, next weekend, you guys play a show in Hamilton, Ontario that is both the first and last ever concert at Ivor Wynn. Any thoughts on that?
Pretty excited about it. You know, it's Saturday night, so we're hoping for some good weather. And you know, I think there's going to be a good crowd there. You know, it's a shame the stadium's closing, but... all good things, you know, and it should be fun. We're feeling pretty warmed up, so you know, kind of jumping in from this little tiny store that we're playing into a much bigger venue, but we're looking forward to it.
Well, I wish I was seeing you at the tiny store, but you know, Montreal is home. I will be making the trek down to Hamilton next weekend to see you guys with good local Montreal boys, the Sam Roberts Band.
Love those guys. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, they're playing with us too, and always nice. Played a lot of shows with those guys over the years.
Yeah, several here that are pretty up there on my list, Paul. I want to thank you so much for your time tonight. Really appreciate it. Know you have you still have a show to play tonight. So
yeah, we're going on pretty soon, I think. That's
awesome.
What I'm hearing.
Good stuff. We'll see you down the road, and always appreciate the time.
Okay, thanks. Great to talk to you guys.
Thank you, Paul.
Okay, we'll see ya.
thanks to Paul Langlois of The Tragically Hip, my favorite band. This is Goodnight at a Wapiscat from Now for Plan A. Go pick it up. Yes, there are. Welcome back to the Kaufman Show. Dave Kaufman and Jay Farrar back alive with you. It's been a while. We don't usually pre-tape our interviews, but...
Well, when you got big stars like that, hey, you do whatever they ask you to.
That's absolutely correct. Jay and I were here at 3 o'clock this afternoon. We were here at... Actually, it was more like 2:30.
Got to make some concessions for guys like that.
Tonight. Hey, man, I'll do it anytime. I wish we could run in here 3 times a day, 5 times a week. I think that would be pretty cool.
I'm not sure I wish that. 1 time a day, 5 times a week.
It'd be awesome to speak to guests like that every night.
Yeah.
Every night of the week.
Okay.
That would be a lot of fun.
Pay my gas. I'll be happy to come and do it.
I will pay your gas.
Wow. Dave.
Make it happen, Jay. I will pay your gas.
Just sign over here, please.
Who's your pick for AL MVP?
AL MVP.
This has been the nonstop conversation everywhere I go. It seems to be down to two gentlemen, and it seems that Civil War-type arguments are breaking out over Mike Trout and Miggy for MVP.
Steve Trout, isn't it? Isn't it Steve Trout?
No, it's Mike Trout.
No, I know.
Steve Trout.
Old Chicago Cubs pitcher. That's
first of all, have you seen either of them play this year?
I have. It's so hard. Depending on whether Miguel Cabrera wins the Triple Crown.
Who cares? Why does that matter? We've already established stats aren't...
But you got to let me finish.
Sorry. Civil War type arguments.
That I would consider him in the conversation. Otherwise, I'm going with Trout.
That seems insane. So Encarnacion in Toronto goes on a run this week and ends up hitting more home runs than Cabrera. That disqualifies him from being the most valuable player of the league?
Who? Encarnacion?
Well, Encarnacion would be the guy who would end up breaking the home, hitting more homers than him. He's the guy who's closest for home runs.
No, either way, I'm going to go with Trout. That's what I'm going to do.
Okay. Here's how I see it, Jay.
I would consider Cabrera even a close second because RBI statistics, batting average statistics, and home run statistics don't mean what they used to mean.
None of those account for defense.
They no, and Cabrera is not even an average fielder. No, he's less than average.
But man, Trout,
he's in Manny Ramirez
Trout
territory.
Is well above average defensively.
Oh yes, he's fantastic.
Trout, I think, is also on the verge of stealing 50 bases this year.
Yeah, and you know what? There are so many questions about the definition of MVP. Everybody, I mean, I wish they would. It's like the Hall of Fame. I wish they would have a certain criteria, 10 things where you put a check mark on that you qualify for, you know, a list of criteria that, you know, this guy's either a Hall of Famer or an MVP, because there are constant arguments about the very definition of the award. MVP, most valuable player. Well, is he most valuable player because he was valuable to his team? Or was he just the best player in the league?
Well, we've seen A-Rod win and Andre Dawson with the Cubs. Yes. An MVP on a last place.
Yeah, and this is what encourages the argument.
Sure.
You know?
But it's insane. I mean, for the sake of the conversation right now, and then also people are saying Detroit's going to end up making the playoffs. Anaheim probably won't. Therefore, Cabrera should have it. If Anaheim played in the AL Central, they'd be in the playoffs right now.
It's completely ridiculous. I mean, it's kind of the Dan Marino syndrome. You know what I mean? I could only imagine had he had an inkling of a better squad in front of him, what kind of damage he would have done. So, I mean, I hate that argument. I hate the argument where people say, well, why should he be in the Hall of Fame? He's got no rings, man.
But
this is the stupidest thing I've ever heard.
The argument right now is, should
keeping it relevant,
Cabrera win the MVP if he wins the Triple Crown? And for me, I find it just a ridiculous argument.
Yes, I
don't understand it. And the only thing that I can think is that it's this sense of nostalgia from the old guard.
Right.
And if you look at the way this has sort of lined up right now, most of the younger generation of baseball writers, reporters, analysts are on Trout, and most of the old guard is with Cabrera. And I think it's that nostalgia for Yastrzemski and seeing the Triple Crown, which you saw when you were a little kid.
I don't even know if it's about the Triple Crown itself or the ancient idea that these stats are relevant.
I didn't call them ancient now. I just said they're old.
It's ancient. Whatever. Old is ancient. Whatever. Antiquated. That these stats are as relevant as they were in 1967. Home runs, average, RBIs are not as relevant anymore. I know they're the big stats and they get all the credibility and everybody looks up to that, but it's a different baseball game. This changed
frankly,
about 10, 15 years ago.
There are more refined metrics for evaluating.
More refined.
Talent.
You've got the RISP. You've got the on-base percentage. Stealing is such an important stat. People don't realize how hard, especially this day and age, stealing is almost a lost art.
I prefer the stealing stat that factors in your caught.
Right.
I think that,
yes,
that makes
that's
way
a,
more sense.
Yeah, that's a great point. That's
you know,
a great point.
If a guy has 50 stolen bases on the year, but he's been caught, you know, 35 times.
Yeah, it just means
impressive.
He goes more often,
right.
You know. Yeah.
Exactly. But then there's a certain amount of risk and liability in that.
Right. But to be successful in stealing bases, and yes, your stealing percentage is very important.
I bet you Tim Raines owned Vince Coleman and Ricky Henderson in stealing percentage. Bet you. Just,
I could
imagine.
Don't
know the stat. We'll look it up. We'll bring it back to you guys next week. But that
bring
is,
it back to them in 10 minutes if we want.
You're
this
right.
is the
you're
modern
right.
age.
You can take a damn commercial break.
You're damn right. And we'll have it for you.
All right, get on it, Jay.
No, me? We've got two other Greek guys sitting here doing nothing. Let's get them to do it.
But I picked the Greek I like the most.
Okay. Well, if you put it that way.
Let's take a call. We've got Jerry in Snowden. He wants to talk a little bit of baseball with us. And you know what? We like to talk baseball, so we're going to let him. Hey, Jerry, how are you?
I'm all right. Happy New Year, guys.
Thank you. Thank you, and to you.
I'm actually happy Washington won because my late wife and I, we lived 30 years in the Washington, D.C. area. After we moved from Montreal down there. And although we were unhappy the Expos left, we got a good baseball team.
Yeah. Now tell me, when you were living in D.C., was that when the Senators were there?
No.
Okay.
We left here in 1980.
You left Washington in 1980 or Montreal?
No, we left Montreal in 1980 and went down to the Washington, D.C. area.
Okay, and now we're back after 30 years in the D.C.
Yeah,
area.
Yeah, she passed away.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. I get that if you lived there that you would feel differently than say this radio host.
Well, not really, because I remember we were driving our son to university in 94, and they were saying there's going to be a strike, and we were Expo fans, and it looked like that was the end of the Expo's chances of getting into the World Series.
Well, it looked it in 94, but you know what? I was actually, somebody was asking me about that this week, but 96 was a whole other thing where they came very close to making the playoffs.
Yeah, I remember.
2003 for me is really the pinnacle of my baseball fandom. It doesn't get any better than it did up until the last day of August of that 2003 season. I'll hold on to those memories forever.
I remember the first year we got there, well, the second year was 81, and Rick Monday put an end to my excitement with that home run.
Yeah, you and the rest of the city. Luckily, I was only a year old, so I didn't feel the pain. But, Jerry, thank you so much for the call tonight.
Welcome.
We really appreciate it.
Okay.
And again, you know, this whole my whole inner turmoil and confliction about these Washington Nationals who have clinched the NL East tonight. Nothing against the fans, nothing against the players. I totally feel for the fans of Washington D.C. They've had teams up and go on them twice.
Yeah, screw them, bloodsuckers. I don't care.
Who, the fans?
Yeah.
Well, you know what? Then let me have this one.
All right.
Because I want to say that. I think it's important.
Okay.
I spend a lot of time feeling very bitter about the way that the Expos left Montreal.
Right.
But it has nothing to do with the people of D.C. And I think I can remove myself from the situation enough to actually genuinely be happy for them. Doesn't mean I want to watch it, but I'm happy for them. They deserve it, like we do one day. And I just hope this strengthens everybody's resolve. That's my big wish. I know Jay wants them to win the World Series.
And, I want them to win the World Series.
I understand it. I understand it.
Not for the fans.
No, you
see, I have the complete opposite feel. I want them to win, and I don't give a crap about their fans either. You know, I don't care. They had their shot, and I don't know if I could ever. I mean, people talk about
they had their shot. That's not fair, because that type of talk will come back and bite us in the ass.
No, they had their shot three times. There's a difference. There's a difference between being screwed and then not showing up to the ballpark.
I saw you on Twitter this week talking about sins of the father. Last time Washington had a team lose,
doesn't matter. I still blame them.
I mean,
I still blame them.
Was I don't know
just
if
being ignorant.
No,
about
but
it.
You know what I mean, right?
No, but I understand what you mean.
Like,
but
LBJ was president.
But it's not only that. They caught off to a cold start. They built a new stadium, and their attendance is nowhere near what it should be. Now they're winning, so the people are showing up.
Yeah,
but
in cities like DC, I guess, and Montreal, that's how it works.
No, they have a brand new stadium.
We were the only ones there at the end.
They have a brand new franchise. They have a brand new stadium. They're not playing baseball in an old toilet bowl on the other side of town, in a place where you only get 2 weeks of summer every year.
They played in a toilet bowl for the longest time.
Yeah.
RFK was a dump.
Yeah. Nobody showed up. And then they built a new stadium, and they were still at the bottom half in attendance. So I don't really care about them. I don't care. I'm sure they're very nice people. Whatever. move on. But
Washington
Nationals need to win the World Series.
I want to differentiate.
Nobody knows what the hell's wrong with me right now.
What do you mean?
Well, because I'm saying that I want them to win the World Series, but I'm insulting their fans.
Well, I will say most people who listen to The Kaufman Show
will understand why.
Listen to last week's The Kaufman Show. And if you haven't, go to thekaufmanshow.podbean.com.
For my explanation on why I want them to win.
There are a couple of other reasons to check out that website. But,
yeah. But mostly it's about me.
Of course.
Right.
Of course. This is The Kaufman Show with Jay Farrar. I'm Dave Kaufman. I occasionally talk to guests and stuff.
When I let him in.
I play music, though. He can't. I'm still driving the car, so I get to pick the radio
station.
Yeah,
I know.
Sorry, buddy.
That's all right.
I'm with you, though. I want the Nationals to... See, I want them to win so that the feeling goes away, and I won't get into it like I did last week. But
no,
but that feeling is very, very present right now. It's it is a burden and something that is stressful to me.
Mm-hmm.
I take a lot of joy in watching October baseball. I find that I sequester myself for the most part in the month of October and watch as much playoff baseball as I can. I don't have that same excitement for the playoffs, knowing that Washington's going to be at the forefront of it.
Really? I find it so fascinating.
What do you mean?
I just feel that it's a test in the I guess I can tap into the psychology of this city. And this is exactly why I want them to win, because I don't want to see the reaction from the Washington fans. I don't want to. I'll turn it off as soon as they win. I want to see what happens here. Mm-hmm. I want to look around and see the reaction of the people who are here who remember when they had a baseball team. That's what I want to see. And then I can gauge exactly how these people feel and what our chances are of bringing a team back here and what the interest can be.
I don't know if one necessarily, like if the Nats win the World Series and the streets of Montreal are quiet, I don't think that necessarily means that the Expos could never return.
Oh, no, that's not what it's about. It's about the subtlety, just a guy sitting at the bar going, ah, man, you know?
Oh, wow.
That could have been us.
If that was me sitting at the bar right now, Jimmy would have had to hit the delay button.
Yeah, well, and that's it. Gauging the levels of frustration, gauging the levels of, man, that should be us up there. How many people? I'm going to be listening. When World Series time comes and say the Washington Nationals are there, I'm going to be listening and tapping in to this city.
Stay tuned Wednesday for my feature in the Montreal Gazette. I have an op-ed about this.
Yes, and I can't wait for that.
Yeah, it was nice to, honestly, Jay, I needed to get something off my chest. So I wrote, and sometimes writing is incredibly therapeutic for me. I was lucky that the Gazette picked up the story, and it will run on Wednesday. Check section A.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, that's kind of cool.
I'll pick up a Gazette.
We have one of our favorite callers on the line. I'm very excited to welcome Conrad back to the program. Welcome to the Kaufman Show, Conrad.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fantastic. How are you?
Not too bad. You know, my anger is not with Washington. My anger is with Miami.
I understand that.
That's interesting. Blood money.
Blood money. When that happened, there was no place for anything in Montreal. There was no money there. There was nobody to look after it. The fact that the team still continued to exist is one thing. But to me, I might forgive Washington. I might even feel happy for the people of Washington. But for me, my hatred is with Miami.
So you won't feel any kind of sting if the Nationals take it?
Oh, I would say I'll feel a little regret. I would love very much for it to have been us instead of them. But it was inevitable once Miami came into existence.
Interesting point. Conrad, you still cheering for Detroit?
Well, right now I'm hoping for Detroit, yes.
Okay, good. All the best to you in the playoffs. Hope they go far for you.
I'm counting on it.
I'll speak to you soon.
Okay, buddy.
Thanks for calling in. Let's go to Ron in Montreal North. Good evening, Ron.
Yeah, good evening, guys.
How are you?
Not bad, yourself?
Good, thanks.
Okay, two things very important, all right? First of all, okay, I don't remember how old you were when the 94 strike happened.
I was 13.
Okay. They just dismantled the team, all right?
Yes, they did. I remember it vividly, Ron.
I stopped watching baseball, okay?
Yeah.
And quite honestly. Now, the biggest point, okay, and this is where I disagree with Jay, we used to play hockey, okay, in the winter, okay? And we would all play baseball in the summer. I mean, I moved back to the area where I grew up, okay?
Uh-huh.
There was four diamonds, okay? Baseball diamonds, you know, like in walking distance. They're all gone.
Yeah, they're soccer fields now, right?
No, they're all gone. There's nothing. They're not even using them for soccer fields. They're all gone, period.
Well, that was, I'll tell you, Ron, that was something...
You know, like, we all had organized baseball. We all played, you know, like, Little League or whatever you want to call it, Adam or, you know, whatever. I was even a catcher, my good God.
Well, Ron, I'll tell you, for the most part, the municipalities have replaced... I'm not sure what they turned your baseball diamond into, but for the most part they've been turned into soccer fields, because a baseball diamond can cost, if done properly, well over six figures a year to maintain.
I still play organized baseball.
You do?
I played it my whole life,
and in a beautiful park as well.
Yeah, it's a very nice
park.
That's right,
but that doesn't exist all over the city the way that it used to.
No, but
the park I grew up playing at in TMR.
If people want to find them, they can find them.
The park I grew up playing at in TMR is gone.
Yeah.
It's now...
The park I grew up playing at around the corner in Chomedey, Montcalm Park, is gone. It turned into a soccer field as well.
And again, it's a cost.
What did he disagree with me about?
I don't know. I was trying to figure that out too.
All right.
maybe that baseball is still readily available everywhere, which would be going back to a point you made a few months ago.
I didn't say it was readily available. I'm trying to gauge whether people think.
No. I mean grassroots go play on a diamond.
Oh, okay.
I feel like this is a conversation from a long time ago.
Yeah. Listen, baseball is a place you can play anywhere. You could play it in your front driveway. You could play it in your living room. It exists in different kinds of, continuums. As long as you have an imagination, baseball is something you can do anywhere. You can
with
play
a tangerine for a ball and a milk carton for a glove.
We used to play with rocks and sticks. It doesn't matter. It doesn't have to be organized. You don't have to find a beautiful field put up by your community. If there's enough interest in it, you will build the fields. You will find the fields. Baseball is a sport that can be played anywhere at any time.
Congratulations to the Washington Nationals as they make a run in this year's Major League Baseball playoffs.
I won't even congratulate them.
Could have been us. Welcome back to the Kaufman Show. Dave Kaufman and Jay Farrar in on some White Stripes in advance of tomorrow night's Jack White concert at the Olympia. I'm excited. I'm a little bit more apprehensive than I was before reading the reviews from Radio City Music Hall on Saturday night. He played 45 minutes.
No.
Said that the crowd, I was acting like they were at an NPR convention.
That's pretty good.
Didn't know they had NPR conventions.
No.
That'd be a smart convention, frankly. Way more exciting than a DNC or a GOP convention. So, yeah, he only played 45 minutes at Radio City. Now, the thing is, the Olympia Theater is going to be a lot sweatier and messier and nastier than Radio City Music Hall could ever pretend to be. I mean,
right. For
crying out loud, that's the home of the NFL draft. The Rockettes, Jay. The Rockettes! Shouldn't have been playing there anyway.
That's weird. Yeah. What a weird venue for a guy like that.
Rock and rollers tend to play there more and more.
Really?
And,
huh?
Yeah. I don't really get it. I've never seen a show. I've never been there.
Yeah.
I've never been
there. It's like Slayer playing at Place des Arts. I mean, it doesn't work.
I wonder if there's ever been a heavy metal show. Oh, you know what, actually?
So clear there hasn't.
Arkells are doing a show with the Toronto Symphony.
That's cool.
Yeah, they've teamed up with, it's them and Nelly Furtado are combining with the Toronto Symphony Orchestra sometime in late October. I think I'll be at Springsteen that night.
But, nice combination.
Yeah. So that's the thing. I've loaded my schedule with rock and roll this month. I never do that.
Mm.
I'm always at home watching baseball. Again, there's something that's just keeping me away from it. And it's not to say I'm not watching, and frankly, I don't think I've watched as much baseball in years as I've watched in the last week. I watched just a ton of baseball as these races have come down the wire. It's been fantastic, better television than just about any other television I've seen lately. Although I did catch a great show, Ben and Kate.
Ben and Kate.
Ben and Kate. It's a new sitcom. I caught it online after seeing a recommendation on Twitter from Terry DeMonte saying that it was the funniest of the new shows that he'd seen.
Oh, yeah.
I laughed for a half an hour.
Really?
Yeah.
I can't watch sitcoms.
It was funny. It was absolutely funny. I will give it a shot again this week.
Okay.
So that just went from baseball to sitcoms to now where do you want to jump?
Wherever you want, my friend.
Really?
Yeah, Free this is your
this
house.
Is this is the Kaufman Show?
This is it.
Oh, wicked. All right. Well, I need a new book if anybody has any recommendations. I'll accept them through my Twitter account, at The Kaufman Show. You can reach Jay as well at Jay Pub Radio. He loves magazine recommendations.
Magazine?
Well, I don't know. I figured I'll take the book recommendations. You'll take the magazine recommendations.
I have a lot
we'll
of books.
We'll meet once a week and we'll you know, team up and pool our knowledge.
Yeah, that's gross. I have a lot of...
Yeah, it's called a book club. It's
yeah,
filthy.
I know. That's why awful. It's gross. It's awful.
You know that all those things are just excuses to get drunk, right?
No, they're an excuse to gossip about people. They don't even talk about the book. And that wasn't a woman slander. I'm just saying.
No, not at all, yeah. Right?
Well, what am I lying? It's not true. I mean, come on. Let's be realistic here. Well, I've got a lot of books lined up that I really want to get into and read, and they're all sitting on my shelf, and I haven't. As for magazines, I only read one, Skeptic Magazine. It's the only magazine I read.
Skeptic Magazine.
Yeah. Skeptic Magazine.
That's hilarious. Is that a monthly publication?
It is a quarterly publication.
Okay.
Yeah.
That.
It's good stuff. Best stuff I've ever read.
Can I say I don't believe you? Or would that be too skeptical?
That would be cynical.
Oh, cynical. Okay. Yeah. Skeptical would be
maybe bordering on facetious, too.
So what would be the proper skeptical response? Is it really? Does it really come out that often?
Yeah, that's...
That'd be better, right?
That's still a little bitchy, but acceptable.
Well, that's okay. I subscribe to Bitchy Magazine.
Oh, do you?
It's fantastic.
Hey, listen, whatever you keep under your bed is none of my business.
Think people still do that? Or do they keep their
laptops? I don't know.
Do they keep their laptops under their bed?
That's the kind of thing I think about when the power goes out. You know, do people still keep porn magazines under their bed? Do people still do that? Think about
wow.
it. There's no reason for them to.
514-790-1690.
Let us know if
please.
You still do that.
We are conducting a survey for the Pew Research Group and the Democratic National Party.
Yes.
We want to know if... If you still have a magazine under your bed.
Yeah, I mean, with laptops now and everything. It's...
Yeah, the Kaufman Show 1987. Joe, you find this funny, eh? Yeah, you like it. All right, we're bringing you on the hot seat soon. You better come up with a creative answer for it. That's right. Joseph Kearns is back in Montreal. He is playing a huge show next Thursday night, this upcoming Thursday
this
night.
This Thursday, yeah.
Which is the 4th of October.
It is.
At McLean's Pub on Peel, which means you get a two-shot. You get Joe Kearns and you get Jay Farrar. But first, a little more Jack White as we go into break. Cross your fingers for me. I want a good long concert tomorrow. This is The Kaufman Show.
I got no truck with your woman always coming, although when I ain't home. You hand a book to me, baby, try your luck, too tired to get in my song. Street. Tomorrow.
Welcome back to the Kaufman Show. Dave Kaufman, Jay Farrar, we've got some breaking news for you. The Oakland Athletics have defeated the Texas Rangers. They are in. That's right. They are going to the playoffs. Congratulations to Benjamin Christensen, Shaka Brody, and the rest of Athletics Nation with that win. The Angels are out, and Tampa Bay is out. Good seasons by both, but came up a little short. Before we're joined by our guests, our in-studio guests, let's go to the chef in Montebello. And I want to tell you all listening right now to check the podcast in about an hour's time, thekaufmanshow.podbean.com. Full interviews with J.R. Moringer, Paul Langlois from The Tragically Hip. And we're going to do something a little special tonight after the show ends. We're going to record a little bit of a little jam session with Joseph Kearns and Aiden Hamill. It's going to be a lot of fun. So that will be available only through the podcast, which is on iTunes or at thekaufmanshow.podbean.com. As I was saying, let's go back to the chef. What's cooking, chef?
Gentlemen, how are we all?
Good, man. I'm good. How are you?
Great show as usual. Such mind-provoking subjects.
Thank you very much, sir. That is the...
Criminals neck deep in crap. In shit, because I can say it this time of night.
I guess, right?
One of the greatest bands.
It's too late now, chef.
Oh, I heard you say it, guys, ahead of time, so I knew it was cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Hip. I mean, and is Joseph Kearns in the building?
Joseph Kearns is in the building.
Sitting right next to me.
Joe,
over here.
Say hello.
Hello.
There you go.
Oh, listen, I was one of the lucky people, I think, who got to catch your first show in Montreal, the Gary Carter tribute evening we had it over at that other place.
Oh, yes, yeah.
And seriously, I've seen a few shows in my time, but that was, maybe it was just because of the night and the event, but the way that you can turn a song into your own, my friend, is something that's going to carry you along for a very, very long time.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you.
That's I just very, can't very wait to hear more of your own original stuff.
Yeah.
And you still have your buddy with you.
He couldn't come this time, but I brought another buddy who plays the same instrument, so...
Well, okay, you mean a wooden box?
That's
what I said. He sits on a wooden box. I call it an instrument.
Yeah, he brought his seat with him.
It is called the cajon, if I remember correctly.
The cajon.
Is it not?
Cajon, yeah.
Cajon. That's not the cajon, yeah.
The cajon.
You're a real jokester, aren't you?
No, it is a cajon. Yeah.
I thought it was C-A-J-U-N.
No, he slaps a cajon.
He slaps a cajon. I'll just shut my mouth.
Good receiver, that cajon.
Aiden, how are you, sir?
I'm not too bad. How are you?
Welcome to Montreal.
You
talk to the mic, not to me.
Oh, sorry.
That's okay.
Wait, you're in a band?
I don't sing.
He plays the box.
Oh, I see. Okay.
I don't need to sing.
So, Mr. Kearns, what brought you back to Montreal? And, Chef, I want to thank you for the call. Thank you for bringing us into our interview with Joe Kearns. I appreciate it, man. We'll speak soon.
Thank you.
Okay, boys.
All right. Joe, what brings you to Montreal? Back to Montreal so soon.
Back. I just got the gig since being home. I got a few gig offers from being back over, so... I'm over to play a bit. I'm doing McLean's, as you said. We're up in Rawdon on Saturday.
Oh, nice.
In Sims again, so that should be good.
Awesome.
See a few friends. Maybe relax a little this time and not do so many shows.
Oh, good.
We did before. So.
Good. I look forward to relaxing.
And we're enjoying the weather a bit more now. It's a bit colder, so we're not complaining as much.
Oh, it's more like Ireland
now. I'm less red.
Dude.
Come on. You were here for the most beautiful, hottest summer of all time.
We don't do hot, though.
Well, we do. If you want to... Get in with Montrealers, you got to acclimatize.
It was freezing cold yesterday, and we were out sunbathing. And it's mad looks.
Rain bathing.
Well, so you're playing in Rawdon over the weekend, you said?
On Saturday.
And then you're at McLean's. It's the, is it the 20th anniversary? Or is it just the birthday?
It's the birthday.
It's the birthday.
Alexander
Keith. It's the 378th birthday of
Alexander
Keith's.
Like that. We don't know. Anyway, it's an Alexander Keith's extravaganza. We're actually serving lobster at the pub.
Wow.
Yeah, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. And it's always a hell of a party. Every time we do this kind of gig, we go crazy over there. So,
well, and I mean, needless to say, you guys got in touch with Joe and got him to come over from Ireland.
Yeah, and you'll get a lobster and a, you know, a pint.
He's getting paid in lobster, too.
Yeah. Lobster and a pint.
I have to transfer them into a canister.
Yeah. It's not a bad gig, and the kitchen will be... working hard on the lobsters.
You can hear them screaming from the kitchen.
Yeah, that'll be awesome. I love animals suffering like that. It's great.
Joe, as I watch pictures behind you on the TV screen of the Washington Nationals dousing each other with champagne and celebrating, please cheer me up and tell me how the career is going on the other side of the pond.
It's going good, finally. Yeah. We're on the radio now, regular airplay. We're not turning down gigs. We're not chasing gigs. We're turning down gigs for once. So
sweet.
Yeah, no, it's good. I did a bit of traveling. I was in Luxembourg and Germany and Italy and Cologne. So England. So I was home for a very little amount of time since leaving here, you know. So yeah, no, it's going very well. I mean, it's nice to be back to a place where you have friends around as well, so it doesn't have to be just work. You can take some time off and have a few drinks and stuff, you know.
I'm hoping we can end the show early so we can do exactly where that, Joe, okay? Hold your horses.
I can't believe I'm on the radio. 10 minutes and Variety says, I'm dying for a drink.
Didn't take
long.
I'm
Mr. Stereotype. There you go.
That's why we brought you on at 1:15, my friend.
I'm drunk.
No, you're not. No, you're not. Everybody has to blow into a breathalyzer before they step into the studio.
Oh, yeah, right. There'd be nobody here, Kaufman. You'd be by yourself.
Jimmy, tell me you're sober. I think he just nodded.
He was so
know.
Sober that he was so. Too lazy to lean over and turn on the mic. It's like, I'm
so
sober.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Jay, do you have any pertinent questions for Mr. Kearns?
No, not really. I mean, I
do you have any non-pertinent questions?
They're mostly non-pertinent.
You follow the Olympics?
Oh my goodness, yeah, religiously.
Yeah. I knew you were big into it when I was here.
Yeah.
How did Canada do? How did
you
do?
Oh, you.
Oh, wait a minute. Are you?
I got Dave to swear.
I can see it in his face. He knows exactly how we did.
What did we do? Six. How many medals did we win?
We won a bunch of bronze.
30.
Didn't Canada come in, I think, 13th overall in the medal standings?
Yeah. How did Ireland do?
Not that good.
We had to give some back, did we?
I bet you guys won more gold than we did.
We won there was a girl, Katie Taylor. She's you probably heard of her. She's pretty famous all around the world now.
Well, at least in the Irish parts.
No.
Of the world.
She got female.
Like Ireland.
She got female boxing.
Yes, absolutely.
Somebody Irish winning a boxing title. That's amazing.
Yeah, it's shocking.
Now, are the Irish better at the Winter Olympics or the Summer Olympics? Or would you just excel at a rainy sawdust Olympics or something like that?
We just turn up and hope for the best, you know.
Do the Irish compete?
I'm very good at fighting.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's yeah.
Do the Irish compete in the Winter Olympics?
Yes. Yes, they do.
Yeah. Right. Irish bobsledding. I saw Irish bobsledding in Whistler.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. And a lot of the crowd was dressed up for them.
That's what you want to do. Yeah. Put five Irish guys together in a piece of plastic and send it going down a mountain on some ice. That's beautiful.
I feel like we could say the same about so many nationalities.
Oh, yeah. Well, I know, and I will.
Okay.
I will.
Good.
I'm not done yet.
That's like the film Cool Runnings, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah. Well, Jamaicans.
Feel the rhythm. Feel the rhyme.
The Irish Jamaican accent might be the most adorable thing I've ever heard in my life.
Adorable.
But that's what happens when people can't do a proper Jamaican accent. It's the opposite. When people try and do an Irish accent a lot, they do that a lot at the pub. It ends up sounding Jamaican for some reason.
It's that slap at the bus, man. Yeah. And I love you, man, right?
Yeah, exactly.
You sound like a leprechaun.
Yeah.
Jimmy, we've got a phone call. Why don't we check out?
How's the album doing, by the way?
Good.
Selling some copies?
Yeah. It's still selling.
Good stuff.
I left a few here, so I have to see how it went.
I would imagine there are very few left, but I think we know who printed them, so I'm sure a few more could be.
Could be
released to the public.
Yeah, we do. Do we? Oh yeah, we do.
Do you have any of your songs available on iTunes?
No, not yet. It's
you need to speak to my brother. I think you need to speak to my brother.
Yeah, I will.
I think he could show you a bit about the business aspect. Actually, he should speak to Ingrid, my brother's girlfriend.
DJ Sparkle.
Yes, DJ Sparkle will take care of you.
I'd like to see them collaborate.
Who?
Anakin Slade and
Joe Kearns.
Yeah, that'd
be
great.
That'd be wicked. Oh, that'd be awesome.
Well, if you explore YouTube a little bit, you'll see that my brother does a lot of acoustic sets with his songs. He tries to mix it up a little bit. So, I mean, that would be very, very interesting.
Yeah. And we all know that at a certain point in time in the spring, I was very partial to Joe's cover of Gangsta's Paradise.
Oh, we dropped that.
I know. It's cool. You know, you can only hear it so many times before it loses its luster. Yeah.
We're trying something else that's a bit...
I demand that you do that on Thursday.
Oh, no, we will. But if Dave turns up, we'll do it before Dave turns up.
Perfect. Thank you. I actually have a benefit to go to on Thursday night that I was invited to this morning. I can't say the name of it.
The benefit?
Yeah.
Why not?
Because it's called blank cancer.
Okay.
It rhymes with muck cancer.
Oh, okay.
And you have to buy a t-shirt. And they sell different t-shirts, and each t-shirt says muck, except it's with an F, cancer, on it.
Yeah.
And t-shirts are all different colors to represent different types of cancer that they're raising money for.
Oh, that's great. And use the Battlestar Galactica. Frack cancer. Yeah.
For sure. There you go. Perfect. And I don't know, maybe we'll talk about it on the Uncensored podcast a little later. But
it'll be much easier, yeah.
It will be much easier, but that's at the AMC Forum on Thursday. But going to one would not prevent you from going to see Joe and Aiden play the Alexander Keith's birthday party at McLean's Pub on Thursday night.
Yeah.
So we'll see you all down there.
It's all weekend long, by the way, if anybody wants to know. Just come down, and we'll have Salty Dog there on Saturday. Also a great group.
Absolutely. Montreal local legends.
Yes.
Salty Dog.
Yeah.
Who I think I saw there last time Joe played the pub.
Yep. Yep. Same night. Great sounding guys. Bit of a maritime twang to their sound.
Joseph Kearns and Aiden Hamill, thank you for your time, guys.
Cheers, guys. Thanks
very much.
And once again, to everybody listening at home, stick around and check out the Podbean, coffinshow.podbean.com. In about an hour's time for some exclusive performances from Joe and Aiden. I want to thank our guests tonight. Paul Langlois from the Tragically Hip, my favorite band. And, you know, we'll say this about both guys that we had on tonight. Nicest guys. Just seemed so happy to talk to us.
We couldn't believe that they were so happy to talk to us. I was like, dude, why are you so happy to talk to us?
J.R. Moeringer, who wrote The Tender Bar and helped Andre Agassi write Open. His new novel called Sutton is fantastic, and I encourage you all to pick it up. And even though Jay might not like it, we can have a little book club and talk about it.
Or gossip about people. Like a hen house.
And get drunk.
Like a crappy episode of The View.
Last week I... very briefly told you guys that I was hoping to do something and that it would be a bucket list type thing that I never thought I'd get to do, and I kept it very vague. I went to the Tragically Hip's recording studio this weekend, and I just want to thank from the bottom of my heart Kristen Bassandry, who is a local talent and was there recording her album. Kristen and I go way back. We've been friends since high school. And she knew how much it would mean to me to check out that place. So she invited me down there, and that was special. I'll never forget it. So thank you, Kristen. And I hope you enjoyed the show tonight. It was fun. With miniature Tim, if he needs a tune, then I'll write one for him. We like the same books and we like the same sounds. There's a reason that I love this town. I played a show in Kelowna last year. Said, pick it up, Joel, we're dying in here. Picture one hand clapping, then picture half that sound. There's a reason that I hate that town. If you saw my band in the early days, then you and me face down in our suit, some French restaurant. I saw Riviere de Loup last night at the tour. We burnt the place to the ground. There's a reason that I love this town. There's a reason that I love this town. You've been listening to The Kaufman Show. For Miguel Cabrera, I'm Mike Trout, and we'll be back next week.
What'd that sound like?